From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross. On today's Fresh Air, the man behind the Marvel, Stan Lee of Marvel Comics. He co-created Spider-Man and originated many of the most popular superheroes, including the Incredible Hulk, X-Men, and the Fantastic Four. Lee introduced angst and neurosis into the superhero formula and revolutionized comics. He'll talk about his more than six decades working in an industry populated by marauding green-skinned monsters and masked men. His new book is called Excelsior, The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. Also, book critic Maureen Corrigan reviews the new suspense novel by African-American scholar Stephen L. Carter. It's the Yale law professor's first work of fiction. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From NPR News in Washington, I'm Corey Flintoff. The White House has begun handing over documents subpoenaed by a Senate committee that's investigating administration contacts with the Enron Corporation. NPR's Don Gagne reports from the White House.
The deadline for the Bush administration to comply with the subpoena was Monday noon. It was extended 24 hours. That deadline also passed. Then, some 5 hours after that, the White House agreed to begin handing over the documents the Senate panel has been seeking. The White House said the dispute centered on certain personal information contained in the documents, things like email addresses and Social Security numbers. And because of that, they required a promise that the documents would be handled with sensitivity. Now a White House spokesman says they expect the committee to use the information in a thoughtful and deliberative manner. Some Democrats in Congress have accused the White House of stonewalling and doing everything it can to avoid turning over the documents, which include records from both the president's office and that of Vice President Dick Cheney, who chaired the White House Energy Task Force. Don Gagne, NPR News, the White House.
Despite diplomatic pressure from Russia, China, and other nations, the leaders of India and Pakistan have refused to meet face-to-face to discuss the issues that have brought them to the verge of war. Both Indian Prime Minister Atal Bihari Vajpayee and Pakistani President Pervez Musharraf attended a Central Asian summit meeting in Kazakhstan today. The two nuclear-armed neighbors have massed troops along their border in the disputed region of Kashmir. Musharraf refused today to renounce any first use of nuclear weapons, although India has said it will not be the first to use them. The U.S. Conference of Catholic Bishops has issued a series of recommendations on how the church should respond to the child sexual abuse scandal. The proposals will be debated when the bishops meet in Dallas next week to implement new policies. NPR's Duncan Moon reports.
The report by the conference's ad hoc Committee on Sexual Abuse calls for the removal or defrocking of any priests who sexually abuse a child in the future. The committee also recommends that future violations be turned over to law enforcement authorities for investigation and prosecution. But it does leave open the possibility that those who committed a single act of abuse in the past might be allowed to return to active ministry. Critics say the report is short on specifics and that there is nothing binding that will force the bishops to implement new policies. They're also concerned that it does not address how to deal with bishops who knowingly reassigned abusive priests, allowing them to molest other children. The committee says their report is only a series of recommendations that will be hotly debated in Dallas next week before the bishops settle on a definitive policy. Duncan Moon, NPR News, Washington.
In stocks today, the Dow Industrials lost 22 points to close at 9,687 in heavy trading. The Nasdaq gained 15 points, or 1%, to close at 1,578. This is NPR News. Prosecutors in New York have announced the arrests of 17 alleged members of the Gambino crime family, including two brothers of the imprisoned mob boss John Gotti. One of those brothers, Peter Gotti, is the reputed acting Gambino boss. NPR's Melissa Block reports from New York.
The charges include racketeering, extortion, money laundering, and witness tampering. Those arrested are accused of maintaining a stranglehold on unions and businesses along New York City's waterfront. They're alleged to have used threats of force and violence to assume control of the Brooklyn and Staten Island chapters of the International Longshoremen's Association. The U.S. attorney in Brooklyn, Alan Weingrad, said in announcing the arrests, "When it comes to the waterfront, the greedy grip of organized crime knows no bounds." Prosecutors say a Gambino Filipino associate also attempted to extort hundreds of thousands of dollars from someone in the film industry who was not named. According to published reports, the action star Steven Seagal was the victim of the alleged extortion. Seagal's former business partner Julius Nasso is among those indicted. Melissa Block, NPR News, New York.
The former head of Tyco International has been charged with tax evasion. Dennis Kozlowski pleaded not guilty during his arraignment this afternoon in New York on charges that he used false documents to evade about $1 million in sales tax on paintings. Kozlowski is also accused of conspiracy, tampering with physical evidence, and falsifying business records. The Tyco Corporation is already under scrutiny for its accounting practices. Critics have accused the company of inflating its profit growth with accounting tricks when it acquired new companies. Kozlowski resigned from Tyco yesterday. Corey Flintoff, NPR News, Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Wellington Management, providing investment advice to clients worldwide, and the Corporation for Public Broadcasting.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave, in for Terry Gross.
With great power comes great responsibility.
This is my gift.
Wow.
It is my curse.
Who are you?
Who am I? I'm Spider-Man.
That's from the new feature film Spider-Man, starring Tobey Maguire, directed by Sam Raimi, and based on the Marvel comic book character co-created by my guest Stan Lee and Marvel artist Steve Ditko. Starting in the 1940s, Lee served as head writer, editorial and art director, publisher, and chairman of Marvel Comics. He's now chairman emeritus of the company. Lee's superheroes were distinguished by their psychological complexity. They were burdened with self-doubt and existential angst. They include the Fantastic Four, X-Men, Doctor Strange, the Mystic Magician, and the Incredible Hulk. Now in his 80s, Lee continues a full schedule of TV and film projects. He's the executive producer of the new Spider-Man film and of an Incredible Hulk film directed by Ang Lee, which is due out next summer. And Stan Lee has just written a new memoir called Excelsior, The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. When we spoke, I asked Lee about the origins of Spider-Man, whether he first thought of creating a superhero who could crawl up walls or one that was a geeky teen.
Well, I think the geek part came first. I decided I wanted somebody who every one of the readers could identify with, because I think every teenager thinks of himself or herself as somewhat geekish at some time or other. Most teenagers are somewhat insecure and shy and inhibited and introverted. So I figured a hero like that would be very empathetic to the readers.
So in that way, was he kind of a reaction to superheroes like Superman, who was so stiff and proper?
I guess you might say so. Up until Spider-Man and some of the other characters that we did at Marvel, I always felt most superheroes were really... They were two-dimensional, or almost one-dimensional. I mean, they were just good guys who went out to fight the bad guys, and you didn't really know much more than that about them. They had virtually no private lives. It was just a case of, oh, somebody's committing a crime. I'd better become whoever my alter ego is and go get him.
So how did the spider element come in?
Well, with every new superhero, you have to have a new superpower because, as I'm sure you're aware, the superpower is what makes them superheroes rather than regular heroes. And we, of course, specialized in superheroes. I had already done a book called The Fantastic Four, and in that book I had a girl who was invisible, a man who could stretch any part of his body, a fellow who could burst into flame and fly, and somebody who was one of the strongest people on Earth at the time. And I was figuring, or I was trying to figure, what other power can I give somebody? And I saw a fly crawling on a wall. Now, I've said this so often it might even be true. I can't even remember anymore. But I saw this fly crawling on a wall, and I said, gee, wouldn't it be something if a hero could stick to walls and move on them like an insect? And that's how it happened, and lo, a legend was born.
So but why wasn't he Insect Man or Spider-Man?
As a matter of fact, he almost was. Because having decided that was the superpower I wanted to give him, I next had to come up with a name. So I began to think. Insect Man, Mosquito Man, Gnat Man. I mean, anything I could think of. None of them sounded right. I finally got to Spider-Man, and somehow it sounded dramatic. It sounded mysterious. So that was the name I chose.
So you presented the Spider-Man idea to the publisher of then Marvel. Wasn't Marvel yet. It was Timely.
That's right.
Timely
in those
Comics.
Days, in those days, it was called Timely. And I told him I wanted to call the hero Spider-Man. And, oh, man, he was dead set against that. He said, Stan, people hate spiders. You can't. Nobody's going to buy a book called Spider-Man. And then when I told him I wanted the hero to be a teenager, he looked at me as if I was from another planet. He said, Stan, teenagers can only be sidekicks. A hero can't be a teenager. And finally, when I told him that I wanted our teenager to have a lot of problems that the average reader could empathize with, problems like he didn't make out so well on dates, the girls didn't particularly like him, he wasn't even that popular with the boys, he had to worry about earning a living, he didn't have enough money, he had family troubles. That's when my publisher said, Stan, don't you know what a hero is? Those things don't happen to heroes. So I was striking out on all counts.
Now, why do superheroes all wear these spandex costumes? The question of the ages.
That is a very interesting question. Let me take you back in time a bit. Remember I mentioned before Spider-Man I had done a book called The Fantastic Four. Well, that was the first of the so-called Marvel Universe characters. And I wanted The Fantastic Four to be as different from other books as Spider-Man was. So one of the things I decided was I would give none of those characters costumes. Because I always felt if I suddenly developed a superpower, I don't think the first thing I would do would be run to a costume store and say, quick, give me a mask and some spandex. So I just gave them regular clothes, and I published the issue, and we started to get a tremendous amount of fan mail, and most of the letters said something of this nature. Stan, we love the book. The Fantastic Four is great. Are we excited about it? But if you don't give them costumes, we'll never buy another issue. Now, I don't know the reason for that. I have racked my brain. I have tried to research it. I don't know why. But it just seems that the people who like superheroes like to see their superheroes in costumes.
Well, let's talk about the Spider-Man movie. There are a lot of poses directly out of the comic strip in the movie and that recreate Spider-Man, for instance, hanging upside down with his knees out. That's a classic silhouette for Spider-Man. And also swinging through the streets of New York with his arms straight outstretched.
Steve Ditko, the artist, did such a wonderful job of those shots in the beginning that he did of Spider-Man swinging and clinging to walls and hanging upside down. Most people who've read those early books still remember those shots.
Yeah, what do you think that the movie got right in terms of the visual aesthetics?
Oh, I think the movie got virtually everything right. It got the essence of Peter Parker, the shy young man who suddenly comes into his own once he gets the superpower. It got his ambivalence, his feeling that somehow the superpower he had gotten is as much a curse as a blessing. There was one little thing about the movie that I felt could have been better. I never cared for the mask that the Green Goblin had. I think that Willem Dafoe is such a fine actor. I would have loved to have seen his face when he was the Green Goblin. I would have loved to have seen his expression. Somehow the mask, which was solid and unchanging, it to me wasn't as dramatic as actually seeing his face would have been. But that is a small complaint, and I thought everything else was absolutely wonderful.
Now, we have to get into the controversy that fans found troubling, that Spider-Man's
web powers were in the movie were made organic. It was something that grew from his genetically altered spider bite, as opposed to something that, as you had written into the strip,
yeah,
something that he created as a burgeoning young scientist.
How about that? They dared tamper with my creation. well, let me tell you, if I had done the movie, I would have tried to keep it that he created this little web shooter himself. I remember when Jim Cameron thought that he would do the Spider-Man movie a few years ago. He did an outline, a treatment for the movie, a very detailed one. It was more than 50 pages. And he sent it to me. It was a wonderful story, but I noticed that he, too, made the web shooting organic. And I said to him, gee, why don't you keep it the way it was in the book? And he said, well, I think it would be hard to make an audience believe that somebody, some kid, could just create something like that himself. And then we talked about other things, and I went home and I thought about it, and I thought the way I would have done it would be, in the beginning, to show that Peter had always been, he was a science scholarship student. I mean, that was a given. He was a very bright student, and he was winning a scholarship in science. Now, the one thing he was always trying to do, if he ever went for a doctorate, this would be his doctorate thesis, he was trying to find something that could be shot out of a tube and stick to walls and stay, you know, whatever. This web was the thing he was trying to work on, but he never could get it right. However, once he was stung by that bitten by that radioactive spider, suddenly he knew how to do it. It not only increased his strength and gave him spider power, but the bite and the radioactivity, whatever, made him aware of how he could create that web shooter. Now, that's the way I would have done it. But after I thought about it a lot and after I saw the movie, I'm inclined to think that maybe Jim Cameron and Sam Raimi, who did such a wonderful job directing the movie, maybe they were right. Maybe somehow it's more dramatic to see him just do it the way he did organically, and it also saved them a lot of time because it would have taken quite a few extra minutes of screen time to show it the way I had just mentioned. So I really have no problem with it because when you do a motion picture, I think whatever makes the movie good, well, that's the way you should do it. And it doesn't really contradict the way I had done Spider-Man, because the main thing is when I did it, he was able to swing on webs. Well, in the movie, he's able to swing on webs. Where the webs come from, that's really a minor difference. So it may upset the fans, and I'm sorry it does, and I love them for their loyalty, but it really doesn't upset me.
Stan Lee is my guest. He's the former head writer, editorial and art director, publisher and chairman of Marvel Comics. He was a leading creative force behind Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, The X-Men, and many others. He now works in television and film. He's the executive producer of the new Spider-Man movie. And Stan, we're going to take a short break and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Stan Lee. He was the longtime head writer, editor, and publisher of Marvel Comics, where he originated many of Marvel's most masterful masked men, such as The Incredible Hulk, The Fantastic Four, The X-Men, and Spider-Man. Stan Lee is chairman emeritus of Marvel Comics, and he's also the executive producer of the new Spider-Man movie, and he has a new memoir of his years in comics. It's called Excelsior, The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. Now, you grew up in New York, during the Depression, did you read comics as a kid?
Yeah, but I read everything, and comics were included in the everything. In those days, they had different kind of comics. When I was a kid, they were mostly reproductions or reprints of newspaper strips like Dick Tracy and Barney Google and things that nobody would remember now. They weren't the kind of comics they have today.
And not superheroes either.
No, not really. Well, they had, let's see, Flash Gordon. You might call him a superhero.
So how hard hit was your family by the Depression? What, did your dad have trouble holding on to a job?
Oh, we were very hard. Well, my dad was just not a lucky man when it came to finance or to getting jobs. Unfortunately, most of my memories of him, he was unemployed and he spent most of his time reading the want ads. He had been a dress cutter, and I guess there were just no jobs for dress cutters in those days. And I always felt tremendous pity for him, because it must be a terrible feeling to be a man and just not be bringing in the money that's needed for your family.
Did you feel that you had to rush through school to start work to help out the family? I know a lot of Depression kids felt that.
Oh, absolutely. In fact, I worked while I was going to school. I had a lot of part-time jobs, yeah.
So how did you get your start in comics?
Accidentally. I heard there was a job open in a publishing company, and I thought, well, maybe they publish books or magazines. Or I didn't know that they published comics. I didn't know that that's where the job opening was, in the comic book department of this little company. And I took the job as an assistant. I did a little proofreading. I helped erase the pages once they were inked, and I ran errands and did some copy reading, and after a while they let me do a little writing, and then they let me do a little more writing, and that was really how it started.
And this was Timely?
Yeah, it was called Timely Comics at the time.
So what kind of comics were they publishing then? And this is the 40s?
Mm-hmm. Well, they did all kinds, but they were just starting. No, actually, I think it was they started in the middle or late 30s. They were starting with some superheroes. They had the Human Torch, the Submariner, the Captain America, and a lot of other heroes who have been forgotten as the sands of time have obliterated them.
I think you resurrected the Human Torch, though, right?
Yes, that and the Submariner and Captain America, because sure. I liked all three of those characters. So when I started the Marvel line of comics for the company, I brought all three of them back.
Now, radio was really big. Were you a radio fan?
Oh, yeah, I loved radio. They didn't have television then. You know, one funny thing that I've always remembered about radio, and I still get a kick out of it. Sunday night especially, that was in our house, that was family night. We'd eat delicatessen. We'd have hot dogs and beans and some sauerkraut if things were good. And we'd sit around the radio set, and we would listen to Edgar Bergen and Charlie McCarthy, Jack Benny, Eddie Cantor, Fred Allen. It was just wonderful. But the funny thing about it was all the chairs were arranged, all the chairs, three or four of them, they were arranged in a semicircle facing the radio, and we would sit and watch the radio as if it was a television set, and almost everybody did that. When you listened to the radio, you would seat yourself so you were facing the radio, and it didn't seem strange to me then. When I think of it now, I wonder, why did we do that?
It's interesting, because the wonderful thing about your writing was that it was so snappy. It seemed to speak to me of radio, and you loved lots of slogans and alliteration, the Green Goblin,
yeah,
and Doc Ock and Dr. Doom, and I remember something, some incantation. What was it Dr. Doom used to say? By the hoary host.
No, that was Dr. Strange.
No, I get the doctors confused.
We had a number of doctors. Dr. Strange was a magician. I called him the master of the mystic arts.
That's right.
And obviously he would cast spells and he would do magical things. Well, I couldn't have him say abracadabra when he wanted to do something. I felt I had to create little expressions for him, little incantations that he could utter. So I'd have him say things like, by the hoary hosts of Hoggoth, let though and such happen, or by the crimson rings of Sidorok, or I just made up any silly thing that sounded the way I thought it should sound. Funny thing about it was, in later years, I did a lot of college lecturing, and very often people in the audience during the questions and answer period would say, Stan, we've been making a study of the incantations of Dr. Strange, and my friends and I have come to the conclusion that you were very heavily influenced by the ancient Druid writings or by, and you know, they'd mentioned something very obscure that I had never heard of, but it's funny how people will always read more into what you write than you ever put in there.
So you don't think you drew on your early reading or listening to the radio or any of those,
sure.
pop culture?
Oh, sure, I did, but only in a very superficial way. What I mean is I didn't use expressions I remembered reading. I used expressions because I remembered I used to like expressions, but I have no memory at all. I never could remember a specific. The only thing I remember when you were talking about radio— there was a radio program I listened to. I must have been about 8 or 10 years old. I don't know. And I don't remember what the program was, but the introduction, the announcement of it, I felt was the most dramatic thing, and it always stayed in my mind. The name of the show was Shandu the Magician, Chandu. And the way the announcer said it, there was a big gong that would be... I guess you hit a gong the way, if you remember the old J. Arthur Rank movies when they would hit a gong when you saw the name on the screen. Well, the announcer would say, and now, Shandu. And at that point, it would go, bong, the magician. So him saying, and now Shandu, and then that bong, and then the words the magician, I tell you, to me that was the most dramatic thing I had ever heard. So you could see I was corny even as a kid.
Stan Lee of Marvel Comics. He's an executive producer of the new Spider-Man movie. He also has a new memoir, Excelsior, The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. We'll continue our conversation in the second half of the show. I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is Fresh Air.
Spider-Man, Spider-Man, does whatever a spider can. Spins a web any size, catches thieves just like flies. Look out! Here comes the Spider-Man. Is he strong? Listen, bud. He's got radioactive blood. Can he swing?
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble Booksellers and the Discover Great New Writers Program, which features the literary voices of tomorrow today. Information available at Barnes & Noble stores and on the web at www.bn.com. And from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. And by Anchor Books, publishers of the new paperback, Body of Secrets, Anatomy of the Ultra-Secret National Security Agency, by James Bamford. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, Maureen Hargan reviews the new suspense novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park. And we continue our conversation with the man who co-created Spider-Man and helped usher in the golden age of Marvel Comics, Stan Lee. He has a new book about his life and is executive producer of the new Spider-Man film. This is Fresh Air. I'm Barbara Bogave. Let's continue our interview with Stan Lee of Marvel Comics. Along with a team of artists, which included Jack Kirby and Steve Ditko, Lee created the hit series Spider-Man, The Incredible Hulk, X-Men, The Fantastic Four, and many others. He served as head writer, art and editorial director, and publisher of Marvel. He's now chairman emeritus. And at the age of 80, he's working in television and film. He's an executive producer of the new Spider-Man movie. He also has a new memoir of his long career in comics. It's called Excelsior, The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. Lee got his start in comics in the 1940s in New York. In 1942, he enlisted in World War II. During the war, what was your, you enlisted, what was your wartime assignment?
Well, it was very funny. I started out in the Signal Corps, and I trained to go overseas and do wire repairing, and I would be the one who went ahead of the troops and make sure that they had their communications set up. But just before I was going to go overseas, somebody found out that I had done comic book writing, and I was transferred to the Army, to the Signal Corps. I don't even know what the unit was called anymore, but it was stationed in Astoria, New York, and they did training films and they wrote instructional manuals. And I was one of the people who wrote the training films and the instructional manuals. And I was with people like William Saroyan and, I mean, some of the biggest names in Hollywood. And I was the token nobody there. I guess they needed one guy that nobody heard of to show they were democratic. And that's what I spent most of the war doing. I was writing films and training manuals.
Now, after the war, people were really starting to get pretty serious. They wanted to get back to their lives, and certainly they were just relieved and looking for entertainment. What kind of comics sold well in that post-war environment?
Post-war environment was amazing. Everything sold, but what happened was the books, they worked in trends. All of a sudden, everybody would be doing Western magazines, and they'd be selling like there was no tomorrow. Then one day, the sales would slump. So the publishers would start doing crime, you know, cops and robbers stories, and those would sell for 6 months, 8 months, a year, and then those sales would slump. And they'd start doing romance stories. And then when the public got tired of those, there'd be war stories. It was one trend after another, and no trend lasted much longer than a year or so. And it's very strange, because only when the superheroes started, and I really think it's when Marvel started with its group of superheroes, it's as though there were no more trends. Since the early 1960s, superheroes have been the best-selling comic books ever until today.
Now, after the war, you were back at Timely. This hadn't turned to Marvel yet, and you were there in New York. And did all of these trends, did you just jump on them all in a row, whatever DC did or whatever any other comic company would do?
Yeah, that was really... That was pretty much my publisher's formula. He would see what was selling, and then we would flood the market with books in the same genre. And I can't complain. It worked. I mean, he did very well doing that. We weren't that original. I created a few new things, but none of them... I realized later you can't sell something new unless it's promoted, and we did not know or did not care to promote things.
Now, could we talk about the 50s? Because it was an interesting progression. The red baiting scare, McCarthyism, first it hit Hollywood and there were congressional hearings into Hollywood. And then comic books came under attack, too. There was a congressional hearing also which investigated links between comics and violent crime and juvenile delinquency. And I think a New York psychiatrist, Dr. Frederick Wortham, led a kind of comic book witch hunt. What are your memories of this Dr. Wortham's most outlandish arguments? It almost sounds like a comic book.
Well, I was very unhappy about Dr. Wortham because I had read a book he had written. I may have mentioned I was a voracious reader when I was young. He had written a book, I think it was called Dark Legend, about a boy who had murdered his mother. and it was a case history that apparently Wortham had been involved in. I read it when I was about 13 or 14 years old and thought it was one of the best written, most absorbing books I had ever read. And I figured this Wortham must be a great guy. And then years later, to have him be the one who attributed every ill that flesh is heir to comic books, and to be this ranting, raging, rampaging fanatic against comics, I was very disappointed in him. But he literally started a crusade against comics. And in those days, crusades caught on. Anything that any doctor or person who was a psychiatrist or had any title in front of his name said, people would be influenced by. And he really caused a lot of trouble. A lot of comic book publishers went out of business because of his diatribes and tirades.
Well, what were some of his arguments? I think there was something about Robin, of Batman and Robin. He was tremendously offended by the legs, Robin's bear or legs and tights.
He would say ridiculous things like the fact that Batman had this young sidekick, Robin. He'd say, the readers know what the real relationship is between Batman and Robin, and Robin's legs being exposed the way they were. I mean, the things he said were so insane, and it's almost embarrassing to mention them. But he did get the ear of Congress, and a company like EC Comics, which now publishes Mad, they had a lot of books called The Crypt of Horror and The Vault of Terror and things like that. He totally put them out of business. Luckily, they came out with Mad, which was better than any of them, and they've succeeded. But if not for Mad, they would have gone bust. He was a very dangerous person because he could see evil in anything that was written or drawn. And unfortunately, for a while, a lot of people listened to him.
Were you fed up by all this? I mean, was this a point in your career where you thought, maybe I should just get out of this business? This is ridiculous.
Yeah, I wanted to get out, not because of Dr. Wortham, because that was just insanity. That didn't bother me. But what happened was I realized by early 1960 that I had been in this business for about 20 years, and I was still writing pap. I was writing things for young kids. My publisher had said, don't use words of more than two syllables. Don't worry about too much dialogue. Don't worry about characterization. Just tell the simplest stories possible. As you can imagine, I felt what I'm doing is worthless. I'm not getting anywhere. So I was about to quit. And then my wife said to me, you know, Stan, if you're going to quit anyway, before you do, why don't you do one book the way you'd like to do it? The worst that can happen is he'll fire you and you want to quit. So that's when I did this book, The Fantastic Four, and I tried to make them more believable characters and to give them different personalities, and I paid attention to the dialogue and so forth. And from then on, everything was great because the book sold, and I tried to do all the other books I did in the same style. So then I was happy, and I stayed with the company.
Well, the Fantastic Four really pretty much marked the rise of Marvel Comics. That was a real turning point for the company. And what people most remember about the Fantastic Four, I think, is that they were so dysfunctional. It's kind of like a bickering, dysfunctional superhero family.
Well, you're absolutely right. And again, I think that's one of the reasons that they were popular, because just like Spider-Man's Peter Parker being the kind of teenager that the readers could identify with, I think for the first time, the Fantastic Four was a group that readers could identify with. They were not dissimilar to their own families. See, I didn't have a girl, for example, who had no idea that the hero was really a superhero, that her, the man she loved was really a superhero. She knew who he was. In fact, she was engaged to him, and she was part of the team.
This is Sue Storm you're talking about, one of the Fantastic Four. She was Mr. Fantastic's girlfriend, the Invisible Girl.
Exactly. Mr. Fantastic, as he modestly called himself, it was his girlfriend.
I mean, it really was a soap opera.
It was. Right? It was. But you see, to me, every story should be done like a soap opera, because that's what people like. If you don't have the character's personal problems, if you don't have people who are having difficulty relating to other people, if you don't have characters with problems that seem unsolvable and you wonder how will they ever get out of this, then what have you got? You've just got a series of incidents, and you don't care about those, because if you don't care about the characters, you can't care about the story. At least that's the theory I've always used.
Stan Lee's new memoir about his career with Marvel Comics is called Excelsior: The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. We'll continue after a break. This is Fresh Air. I'm talking with Stan Lee. He was the longtime editor, art director, and publisher, and later chairman of Marvel Comics. He now works in television and film, and he's the executive producer of the new Spider-Man movie. He also has a memoir out about his time in comics. It's called Excelsior: The Amazing Life of Stan Lee. Now, the Fantastic Four was a big hit, and somewhere in this stretch of the 60s, you put out a series called Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos.
Yeah.
Very different from the Fantastic Four. And I believe that that series started because of a bet. What was that all about?
What happened was we had been doing very well. The Fantastic Four was a hit. The Hulk was a hit. The X-Men were a hit. Spider-Man was a hit. We then did Iron Man, Doctor Strange, Daredevil. I'm probably forgetting a few others. And they were all doing well. I mean, we now had what we called the Marvel Universe, and we had become the biggest and most successful comic book publishers. So one day, again, I was talking to my publisher, who's a great guy, but we often didn't agree on things. And he said, Stan, what is it that's making these books sell so well? You know, immodestly, I wanted to say it's because I'm writing most of them, but I didn't. But he said, I think it's the titles. I think they are great titles. I said, that has nothing to do with it. So then I said, look, let me prove to you the titles have nothing to do with it. I said, it's the style of the writing. And I mentioned what we just said. Even though they're superhero stories, I'm trying to treat them like soap operas where the characters' personal lives are important. He didn't see it. He said, no, I don't think that's it. I think it's the titles. So I said, okay, you know what I'm going to show you, what I'm going to do for you? I'll make you a bet. I'm going to put out a book with the worst title I can think of, and I'm going to put it out in a field, in a genre that nobody is interested in. And at that time, nobody wanted war stories. I mean, people were sick of them. They were sick of war. I said, I'm going to do a war book. And I thought and I thought and I came up with the title Sergeant Fury and His Howling Commandos, which is much too long a title.
Doesn't alliterate.
That's right. It wasn't alliterative, and nobody knew what a howling commando was. So I said, if I can make that sell, would you believe that? And the fact that it's a war book, there's no reason for it to sell, but if it does sell, it's going to be because of the style in which it's done. So we did it, and Luckily, sure enough, it sold, and he grudgingly admitted maybe I had a point there. But we couldn't kill the book. Personally, I hate war stories, so after, I don't know, a year, 2 years, whatever it was, I dropped the book, and we got so much mail from readers, we had to continue it. I didn't want to do new stories. I just reprinted the ones we did. Those sold just as well as the original ones. In fact, we kept it going for years. And the character was so popular that today we have him as a colonel. He's no longer a sergeant. We have him in the present as a colonel, the head of a group called SHIELD. But I forgot to mention one other thing. It was also a book that had the first ethnic group of heroes. In Sergeant Fury's platoon, we had a Jewish soldier named Izzy Cohen. We had a black soldier, an Italian soldier, a Scandinavian soldier. We even had a gay soldier. And this was in the middle 1960s, and I think it took a little courage to do it then. And everybody said to me, oh, the book won't sell in the South, it won't sell in the East, it won't sell in the West. It sold all over, proving that people are really more broad-minded and smarter than anybody gives them credit for.
So tell me about this gay character. What was the story with him?
The gay character?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, well, he was just one of the members of the platoon. His name was Percy Pinkerton. He was English. And his weapon, he carried an umbrella. I mean, he also carried a gun, but he would use the umbrella also to confuse people. And I mean, I didn't play up the gay part, but somehow you could assume he was gay in reading the stories. But he was brave and nice and friendly, and everybody liked him. And he was one of the platoon, one of the guys.
A lot of kids who grew up in the Depression felt very insecure financially and chose very stable careers. Did you ever feel that this just is not the career for a grown-up and just not stable and financially secure enough for you?
Well, I think for the first 20 years, I felt this is definitely not the career for a grown-up. And very, very often, I wanted to leave, to quit. But I would get a raise, or I'd work with a new artist and get interested in what we were doing, or something would happen to make me decide to stay a little longer. But my biggest regret was, during those early years, nobody had any respect for what I was doing. Nobody cared about a fellow who wrote comic books. I would be at a party and somebody would come over and say, hey, what do you do? And I knew what was coming, so I tried not to tell. I'd say, oh, I'm a writer, and I'd start to walk away. But the person would follow me. Really, what do you write? Oh, stories for young people. And I'd walk away further. But finally, what kind of stories? At some point, I had to say comic books. And at that point, the person would turn away as if I had the plague. I mean, it just was the bottom of the cultural totem pole. Now, it's changed now. Now every movie producer is looking for a new comic book to make a big-budget movie out of, and it's a whole different world. But in those days, another bad thing about it, I thought, even if I quit, what would I do? I couldn't go to Time magazine and say, hey, I'd like to work for you now. I used to do comic books. You know, nobody would be impressed. I felt I had wasted so many years because it wasn't leading to anything. And that was another reason that I kind of just stayed there.
Did it make you nervous, though, and maybe accounts for the real drive that you seem to have had? I mean, you had a huge creative drive.
Yeah, I get. Well, you know what really made me that way, perhaps? It was my father. I used to just wish that poor man could find a job. And I was stupid. That's why I'm not a businessman. Instead of me wanting to maybe create comics for myself and for my own company, which I could have done, all I wanted was a steady job. To me, it seemed as if having a good job, a steady job, is the greatest success a person could attain, only because my father never had one. And I think that's another reason that kept me at Marvel, or at what was then Timely, so long, because I felt at least I've got a job, you know? And I really should have left and tried to start a little something of my own, but, well, I didn't know.
Stanley, I want to thank you so much for talking with me today.
That's it. I'm just getting started.
Stanley is an executive producer of the new Spider-Man movie. He talks about his long career with Marvel Comics on a new DVD made with filmmaker Kevin Smith called Stan Lee's Mutants, Monsters, and Marvels. Coming up, a review of the new suspense novel by law professor Stephen L. Carter. This is Fresh Air. It almost seems a requirement these days that thriller writers attend law school first and then begin their successful literary careers. Think of John Grisham, Lisa Scottolini, Brad Meltzer, and Scott Turow. Aside from Oliver Wendell Holmes, it's much more unusual for a well-established legal scholar to attempt to write imaginative literature. Now Yale Law School professor Stephen L. Carter has broken that precedent with his new suspense novel, The Emperor of Ocean Park. Book critic Maureen Corrigan says it's a no-fault case of terrific storytelling.
For the past 20 years, Stephen L. Carter has been a professor of law at Yale University. He's also become prominent in the world beyond the academy because he's an African-American scholar who argues passionately against affirmative action. In addition, Carter has written 7 polemical books for a wide readership on subjects like civility and the conflict between secular law and religious belief. But man, has this guy ever been wasting his time? All these years, Carter has spent intellectually noodling around. He could have devoted to what clearly now turns out to be his true calling, writing brilliant suspense fiction. The evidence? A page-turner of roughly 600 pages called The Emperor of Ocean Park, which is surely going to be the Smarty Set's must-read vacation book this summer. I say Smarty Set because along with murders, missing manuscripts, double agents, tricksters, and plot twists aplenty, Carter also tosses in sharp, droll insights here on identity politics, grade inflation, affirmative action, the decline of morals, and, infecting every page, America's chronic case of racial sickness. Like other first-rate thriller writers, Graham Greene, John le Carré, Ken Follett on a good day, Don DeLillo when he's in a certain mood, Carter gleefully realizes that the suspense genre is social commentary that packs a pistol. In The Emperor of Ocean Park, Carter leads his readers into worlds within worlds, the upper echelons of academia, the law, the federal government, and foremost, the neighborhoods and social haunts of the black bourgeoisie. Carter escorts us into the elegant urban mansions along Washington, D.C.'s Gold Coast that are owned by wealthy African-American professionals. He also takes us out to the historically black resort town of Oak Bluffs on Martha's Vineyard. Through his beleaguered hero, Talcott, nicknamed Tal Garland, who, like his creator, is an African-American law professor, Carter probes deep into the necessarily paranoid double consciousness of a successful black man in America. Tal is a guy who recognizes from hard experience that no matter how many academic degrees he attains or how many crimes he solves, he'll never clear himself of the suspicions his skin color automatically generates among so many white Americans. The Baroque plot of The Emperor of Ocean Park is so ingeniously and frantically constructed that it defeats summary, but here's a shallow attempt. Tal's father, the eminent judge Oliver Garland, dies, or is murdered, in his Gold Coast house one evening. The judge was a cryptic, embittered man, given to referring to his fellow African Americans as the darker nation. At one time nominated by Reagan for the Supreme Court, the judge was defeated and publicly humiliated by his questionable friendship with a major criminal. Upon the judge's death, Tal is besieged by a crowd of weird characters who insists that he knows the secret location of the judge's arrangements, whatever they are. Slowly, Tal is drawn into the mystery of hunting for this MacGuffin, this rosebud, eventually catching on that the obsession with chess he shared with his father may be essential to decoding the clues that are coming to him via the mail and the morgue. Meanwhile, Tal's promiscuous wife, a preppy black attorney nicknamed Kimmer, has been nominated for a federal judgeship, and she warns Tal that if he doesn't stop his embarrassing investigations, the marriage is kaput. Like many another suspense hero, however, Tal is caught between the proverbial rock and a hard place, because he's also been anonymously threatened that if he does stop hunting for the arrangements, his wife and his beloved 3-year-old son will be subject to a grisly fate. Carter's humor, his gift for drawing out the gothic atmosphere in the vast shadowy houses and Ivy League buildings Tal inhabits, his unapologetic delight in melodramatic literary trappings like moonlit cemeteries, and his unflagging ingenuousness make The Emperor of Ocean Park a first-rate suspense tale. But above all, it's Tal's upright sensibility and his depressive, smart voice that lingers. Listen to him here talking about the contemporary state of legal education. Nowadays, I earn my bread by writing learned articles too arcane to have any influence, and trying to stuff some torts or administrative law into the heads of students too intelligent to content themselves with B's, but too self-absorbed to waste their precious energy on the tedious details one must master to learn A's. Most of our students crave only the credential we award, not the knowledge we offer. And as generation after generation, each more than the last, views us as merely a vocational school, the connection between the desire for the degree and the desire to understand the law grows more and more attenuated. Tal is the kind of straight-arrow, Jimmy Stewart-type scrapper you would want to have beside you when the bullets are flying, as well as in front of you in the classroom, educating you about the law in the books and the law of the streets.
Maureen Corrigan teaches literature at Georgetown University. Fresh Air's executive producer is Danny Miller. Our senior producer today is Roberta Shorrock. Our interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, Naomi Person, Monique Nazareth, Anne-Marie Baldonado, with Megan Howell, Patty Leswing, Jessica Chu, and Lauren Krenzel. Our engineer is Audrey Bentham. For Terry Gross, I'm Barbara Bogave.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced, and by Delta Trade Paperbacks, a division of Random House, publisher of Moon Women by Pamela Duncan, available in paperback. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, we meet the filmmaking team, brothers Paul and Chris Weitz. Together, they wrote and directed the new film, About a Boy, based on the novel by Nick Hornby. The Weitz brothers also co-directed the movies American Pie and Down to Earth, and they made their acting debut in the indie hit Chuck and Buck. Join us for the next Fresh Air.